This is the 2 North Jackson Podcast with news, insights, details, and accomplishments from Alabama's 67 county governments. Hello and welcome to the podcast for July of 2022. Today we'll explore the state of our economy, look at Alabama's mental health challenges, and focus on the transition in leadership at the county commission level. We'll begin with a look at the rising inflation and the impact that it may have on county government. Our guest today is Paul Wynn, Senior Vice President with Morgan Stanley, and Paul's been providing financial advice and insight for more than 34 years. Paul is a familiar face to those of you who are participants in the association's insurance fund, as he is the longtime advisor to those two funds as they maintain the interest of the association's insurance programs. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Sonny. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Paul, let's begin with a look at the rapidly changing issues and conditions that may impact county government as officials begin to focus their time on the development of the new budget for the fiscal year 22-23. Certainly, there's been a lot of discussion about inflationary issues in the last few days. Put some of that in perspective for us, if you can.
Sure, Sonny. Everybody knows about the inflation problem we're having and what the government's trying to do to fight it and the talk about, is this going to cause a recession? So let's start by examining what inflation is. And in my opinion, inflation is simply too much money chasing too few of goods. And I think it's good to sometimes just kind of use an example. So let's start with everything in balance. You got just the right amount of money, and you have the right amount of goods to buy with that money. So there is no inflation. Everything's in balance. However, if you change one or the other, you could have a problem. So let's just look at one. Let's change the money supply. Let's say you introduce more money into the system. Well, that alone could be inflationary, as now people are able and probably willing to pay more. And then let's look at the other thing. Let's say we keep money the same, but we reduce the amount of goods available to buy with that money. Well, that could be inflationary, as we all compete now for a limited supply of goods. But now, what if you change both money and supply at the same time? You increased money and reduced supply. Well, then you got a real problem. You got a sharp surge of inflation. And that is what we have now. Money supply has gone up, and the supply of things to buy with that money has gone down. So we have this now perfect storm of inflation. So let's look and see, how did we get in this mess? I think there could be a lot of factors, but in my opinion, there's two main factors. One is the government overstimulation, and two, international development. So let's look at the first one, overstimulation by the government. To help us get through the pandemic, the government gave us about $9 trillion. $9 trillion, not billion, trillion dollars of stimulus. It came in two forms. One was monetary policy, where they lowered interest rates to zero to make it easier to borrow and spend. And the second was the fiscal policy. That's where the government gave us all those checks, including not only checks to individuals, but to businesses through PPP, forgivable loans, and things like that. Now, a lot of the money that they gave us was badly needed. People were losing their jobs. Unemployment had jumped to, I think, around 15%, and people needed it. They were in trouble. But a lot of the money maybe wasn't needed quite so much. So the money supply started expanding, and you add on to that the fact that people were staying at home, not taking vacations, not going out to restaurants. That even increased the money supply. So money supply went to an astounding increase of 40%, and that additional money was inflationary. Now, the second factor, the supply factor, was what we all know about the supply chain. So people were staying home because of COVID. They weren't going to work, and they weren't making things. And then you had the 1-2 punch of the Russian invasion of the Ukraine and the China lockdowns. The invasion of the Ukraine really reduced the supply of much-needed commodities like oil and food, and the China lockdown reduced the output of a whole laundry list of things that we buy every day at places like Walmart and Home Depot. So these factors significantly reduced the supply of goods we buy. And so the combination of this more money and less goods to buy with that money has really got us in the situation we are in now, and it's about as bad as it could be.
Well, Paul, looking at county budgets, much of the revenue is driven by this consumer spending double whammy that you've explained to us. And as counties look at budgeting for income from consumer spending, could you give us a little insight into what might happen and how the inflationary conditions impact consumer activity?
Sure, be glad to, Sonny. So there is no doubt that inflation is this additional painful tax on the consumer. Now, right now, they're having to use those extra savings we talked about that they accumulated during the pandemic to pay for these higher prices caused by inflation. And while they're okay right now, as time passes and they continue to use this extra savings, they will deplete those extra savings. So consumers are very upset right now, and they don't feel good about the economy. The University of Michigan monthly keeps track of how Americans are feeling about everything, and they call it their consumer sentiment report. And it's very widely followed on Wall Street as an indication of which way the economy is going. And right now, on their latest sentiment report, it's the lowest it's been in 50 years. Now, think about that. Consumers are feeling worse now about the economy than they did during the financial crisis, when unemployment was 10%, banks were failing, people were losing their home. So, you know, I don't think it's nearly that bad, but people are feeling really, really bad about the economy, and that's hurt the president's rating and the ratings for his party, suggesting that people are just, you know, really fed up right now with the direction of the economy. Now, so far, the consumer has been able to weather this storm, and spending has held up. And so while inflation has been a little bit of a drag, overall consumer spending has been okay. They've dipped into their savings, like we've talked about. But the other thing that's going on that's helped them get through this is wages have also gone up a little bit. And then now lately, you've got some relief in prices where oil has been dropping and food prices have been dropping. So hopefully that will continue and give us a little bit more relief.
So as you look through a crystal ball for the next few months, what do you see? What advice could you give counties in trying to anticipate what consumer spending may be like in the next few months?
You know, we haven't really seen this type of inflation in over 40 years. That takes us back to the early 80s when the Fed chairman at that time was Paul Volcker. And a lot of your listeners to this podcast may remember that's when the central bank took short-term interest rates to, I think, about 15 or 16%, and mortgages were 15 or 16%. Now, we don't see anything like that happening, but the point is the playbook for this type of inflation is rather rusty. We haven't seen it in over 40 years. So the path most likely from here is that the central bank, the Fed, continue to shrink the money supply by making money more expensive, or in other words, raising interest rates. And also, I would say, more than likely, that any additional talk about stimulus coming from Washington will be quickly shut down. Ultimately, the Fed will continue to raise interest rates until this inflation gets under control. And that's going to have the effect of cooling off the labor market, and that's going to, in turn, lower demand and hopefully slow things down, but it also may have a little effect on the unemployment rate. Now, as far as how high the Fed will raise interest rates is very debatable. At Morgan Stanley, our current thinking is that the so-called terminal rate, that's just the rate that the Fed will get to before they stop raising interest rates, we believe that terminal rate is about 3.6%. Now, currently, they have raised the Fed funds rate to 1.5, so we're not quite halfway there. Now, short-term rates going up will slow demand for things that are interest-sensitive, like cars and homes and business projects. But the thing is, such a scenario of higher interest rates have almost always ended in a recession. Now, we may get through this with a soft landing, that's possible, but it's not very common in this scenario. However, we do think that if we have a recession, it would be rather mild, mainly because we think the job market will stay pretty strong. Since World War II, we've had 12 recessions. Every one of those recessions have ended with not only an economic contraction, but also rising unemployment. However, in this slowdown, employment has held up. For the first quarter of this year, our economy contracted about 1.6%, but unemployment dropped, actually. It went down to 3.6%. So the consumer right now is in pretty good shape. So if we do have a recession, we do think it's going to be a rather mild one.
And finally, Paul, you mentioned rising interest rates, and county governments do have, in some cases, funds to invest. And could the rising interest rates possibly be one small positive out of the current conditions as counties look to work on their budgets?
Yeah, absolutely, Sonny. For the rescue funds, I know a year ago we were talking about earning like a 20 basis points or a quarter of 1%. And now, since our target on those funds is to get to about the average yield of the two-year treasury, that's up to about 3%. Now, that's quite a bit of additional earnings, and those additional earnings can go a long way to help pay for the additional cost that inflation is going to cause on the projects that money is going to be used for. So, yeah, it's going to be very positive.
Paul, we appreciate you taking a few minutes to visit with us. We know you'll be at the annual convention in August. You'll be like Lucy. You'll have your booth set up in the lobby answering all financial questions. But seriously, we appreciate very much the advice that you give to our insurance funds and for the insight you've given us today.
Thank you, Sonny. I will be at the convention, and I plan on hanging out in the lobby for a couple of days and look forward to meeting everybody and answering any questions they may have. So thank you very much, Sonny.
Now we'll turn our attention to the mental health crisis being faced by every county in our state. And today we have with us Tim Burgess, who's the probate judge and county commission chairman in Cherokee County. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Sonny, thank you for having me today. I'm looking forward to our conversation. Appreciate all you do with the association, and I know that all of our different issues that we have across the state, you're willing to take those on, so I really appreciate you talking to me about mental health in general.
Thanks very much, Tim, and we appreciate again your service to the association and to your county. You've been probate judge and chairman for almost 5 years now, but prior to that, you served 13 years as county administrator. So you've seen the challenges that counties are facing from two different seats. And so I thought we would start with you just giving everyone a quick overview of how you as probate judge come in contact with those who need mental health services and who are in crisis, and the services or the help that they're looking for from the county commission and the probate judge.
Thank you, Sonny. I'd be glad to. There are several areas where I come in contact with individuals that need mental health services. First off, I guess the main one would be family members. We have a lot of family members who care about their loved ones, and they really just don't know what to do in certain situations. And from time to time, we'll get a phone call, and that family member will say, "Hey, I've been instructed to call the probate judge because I have a family member who's having a mental health issue, and we just don't know where to turn. So could I please come in and talk with someone about it?" And of course, we always take them in and we talk to them, give them an overview. There have been times when the hospital has called and someone has ended up at the hospital. There needed to be an involuntary commitment because that person is trying to leave. So I'm able to do that for the hospital. Another big area in which I am able to get in contact with them is when law enforcement comes up on a situation. They generally will call, and now we have the new law where they can take them to a facility. But prior to that, they couldn't do anything except transport them, and they would have to have an order from me to get them to the hospital.
Judge, if it becomes necessary to commit a person to put them under the care and jurisdiction of the probate judge at the local level, what kind of resources are available for you to be able to provide the services they need?
Well, first of all, when we do an involuntary commitment, we have to have a bed at the hospital, a psych unit, or some kind of care facility. I use CED Mental Health, which the staff at CED Mental Health do a wonderful job. They're like everybody else. They're short-staffed. Mental health crises are coming more frequently, so they're overwhelmed. So I start with mental health to try to get some sort of evaluation. Mental health helps get a bed for me at a psych ward. Whenever that's accomplished, then we have to have our deputies to go and pick that individual up and transport them to the mental health facility for treatment. Once that takes place, the hold order is good for 72 hours, so we're just sitting and waiting. After some time is gone, then we finally get some communication with the hospital or the doctor. And what they're going to recommend to us is several things. They could want us to release the hold because they're stabilized and the doctor feels that they can be released. The doctor may request that there be an inpatient commitment or an outpatient commitment. The most frequent one is the outpatient commitment. Why? Because there are not a lot of mental health crisis centers available in the state of Alabama. So what the doctors try to do and the medical staffs try to get that person stabilized so that we can do an outpatient and they can go home. Outpatient just simply means that we put them, in our case in Cherokee County, with CED Mental Health. They're assigned a caseworker. Caseworker has a plan for them, and they're supposed to follow up and visit the CED Mental Health Center for follow-up treatment. And this works in a lot of situations, and in some situations it does not. It may work for a while, and then someone may get off their medication. When they get off their medication, they start having issues, and then we start the process right over again.
I think we've all seen these dangerous situations in our own lives, with our family, or with friends and others that we come in contact with. Can you talk a little bit about the resources that are needed for you as a probate judge to be able to help family members and the person who's in crisis as we work toward solutions in those situations?
In the state of Alabama, I'm glad that we've got a couple of crisis centers that will be opening across the state. You know, we need a whole lot more than what we have now. Mental health affects just about everybody or every family. If you haven't had an issue in your family, then you need to consider yourself very fortunate because it touches all of us. There are only three primary places in Alabama: Taylor Hardin, Bryce, and Harper Center, which is more geriatrics than anything else. But see, we only have these few facilities. So what we rely on is the hospitals with psych units, and we're rural, so we have to transport them. Now, I always encourage the individuals while we're waiting on a bed. Sometimes it can be 4 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours, and sometimes we waited a couple of days before we could get a bed available. But when someone's having a mental health crisis, they are a danger to themselves or others. So this is a very crucial time in a family's life. And so when we're waiting, I always tell them, look, if you have to, I know you don't want to, but you'll have to call 911 if we're having a situation that they're wanting to hurt themselves or other people. Depending upon what happens, that person might end up in the county jail. We don't want for that to happen, but sometimes it does. We have people in our jail right now who have mental issues and really need to be in a mental health facility and not in the county jail, but we're all waiting. I know some instances right now where I've talked to the judges about having to bond someone out to get them to mental health. You know, we've had that situation over and over and over in our county. Fortunately, our jail is equipped and we have the type of people that can sort of handle these situations. But the individual themselves really needs to be in a mental health facility where they can be taken care of properly. So we try to process those individuals as quickly as we can.
And is that primarily what happens in Cherokee and then in other rural counties without facilities to provide treatment that are readily available, without the hospital avenue? Does that mean in most cases these folks end up in our county jails?
That's right, because they're having some situation where they may have threatened someone or assaulted someone. You know, someone's trying to help them, but they don't understand, whatever the case may be. And because of that, they end up in the county jail.
And certainly that generates for us a number of challenges, and it generates a number of challenges for the individual and the family. Most jails in Alabama, especially in the rural counties, don't have a mental health ward or wing. It's one of the things we talked about with ARPA money, is counties looking at those kind of expenditures. But short of that, from your view, facing this on a regular basis, what can the association in its role as pulling counties together and trying to speak with the influential single voice, what can we do to try to improve this very complex and quite honestly, Judge, very discouraging situation that we find ourselves in today in Alabama?
Sonny, the association has always been great in its endeavors. And when the association gets behind something, I'm very proud to say that our association is able to get things done. You know, I don't know what the answers completely are. I think the association could do a great job of taking all of this information and statistics and just kind of bottle that and make the people aware of what is going on. But if we could begin to look at what the issues are, take those issues and kind of formulate maybe some law passages that make it easier for a person to receive mental health treatment, to get some funding from the state, to open up some regional mental health crisis centers, and maybe some laws can be passed to help ease the burden for these individuals to get medications. There's all kinds of things that we probably could do, but again, it takes resources and funding to do this. And I hate to sound like we're doing these things so that we don't have to pay for it, but really, county jails are not equipped to handle individuals with mental health issues. The treatment centers is where they need to be. And I think it helps us as a society. It makes our counties, our communities, better places because we are helping people that have real issues.
Well, I think for us as an association, the first thing we can do is part of what I think we've accomplished today in this conversation, and that is to shed some light on the various ways that county government interacts with those who are in need. It's not just the probate judge's responsibility. It's not just the sheriff's responsibility. It's really all of county government. It's going to take a collective solution. We've made strides in the last few years, but we'll get a new set of legislators here in a few months. We'll have another new quadrennium to work on it. And Judge, I appreciate your leadership on this issue and look forward to us keeping a spotlight on the challenges that we face at the local level, but also try to provide some leadership in finding solutions.
Thank you, Sonny. I appreciate your help in this matter. I know the people across the state appreciate it, and I know the probate judges do.
It's Cherokee County Probate Judge and Chairman Tim Burgess. And Tim, we appreciate you joining us today and look forward to seeing you in the weeks ahead.
We'll continue this month's Two North Jackson podcast with a look at transition. County governments all over the state are preparing to welcome new commissioners and new chairmen. Even though the terms will not begin until November, there's a lot of work going on, or work that should be going on, for those commissioners to be ready. And we're in Houston County today and are joined by a longtime County Commissioner, Mark Culver, who has decided that it's time to pursue some non-county things, and newly elected, but not yet in office, Chairman Brandon Shoup. Guys, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
Today, one of the things that has really caught my attention is how closely the two of you are working together intentionally so that Brandon can be ready when it comes time to assume the chairman's seat. And Brandon, if you'd talk a little bit about your preparations for what will happen in November.
Yeah, it's been a good process so far. I mean, certainly took a little bit of time off after the election and going to continue to do that a little bit to spend time with my family, because it is such a huge sacrifice to run, especially in a countywide race. But I sort of liken it to a relay race when you're passing the baton, which is, I think, a good analogy. You know, you don't want to be standing there and somebody run up to you, hand you the baton. You look at it like, okay, what do I do with this? So you try to start jogging, you know, you try to start running so that you can be up to speed when that baton lands in your hands. And Chairman Culver has been very gracious and done a very good job, I think, in trying to encourage me to get up to speed, which is going to be good because there's a lot of things going on in Houston County, and we certainly don't want to drop that baton. I mean, anytime you have someone new come into office, you're going to probably make a few mistakes, and I certainly think that's going to happen, but I want to make as few mistakes as possible.
Well, Mark, I know, as Brandon said, you've intentionally, in a structured way, spent time in trying to make sure that if Brandon's going to get hit in the back of the head with a brick, he at least knows who threw it at him, right?
And knows it's coming, yes. That's been my plan since I decided not to run. We had Brandon and one other sitting commissioner that were running for chairman, and I sat down with both of them, actually, the day before the election, and told them how much I appreciated the race they had run, but also explained to them that I was going to work with either one of them afterwards if they wanted me to, and try to help them understand what being chairman meant as opposed to being a commissioner, because it's totally different. In our county, chairman is a full-time job, so you're here way more than being a part-time commissioner. There are a lot of things that being chairman means that commissioners and the public don't know. Those things Commissioner Shoup needs to be aware of, and so we've spent time meeting with people in the community, meeting with county department heads, and still got a lot more to meet with, but I want him to know the things that you don't know, if that makes any sense. Know who to contact if there's an issue in the courthouse, you know, and it's not a judge. Know where to go at the city if you've got an issue with them. So those kinds of things are what we're meeting about and over, and just want to do the very best I can between now and November 15th to give him as much of the fluff I have between my ears that I've gained over the last 36 years, and try to have him as prepared as he can be. And to Brandon's credit, he has been very willing to listen and be prepared, and I think both of us have Houston County's best interest at heart, and I think we see that being prepared and being ready to work with a new commission, we've got two new commissioners also, is going to be beneficial for him and the county.
Absolutely. And Brandon, I want to, if we can, think back to when you first came into office, and I assume did not have this kind of hands-on transition. What we want to do by talking about this is encouraging other counties, the commission members, the county staff, to reach out to folks who have won the primary election to try to help ease their transition. If you could talk a little bit about, I know you thought you knew everything when you got elected
that first time, and how
that transition went.
Yeah, I guess it's been 8 years ago. You know, you run a campaign based on what you think you know, and I've said this several times, and then you get into office and things are completely different in many aspects. And so you do what you can, certainly try to stay true to your ideals, but there's just a lot of things you can't do. And there's a lot of great ideas that you got that you probably shouldn't do for reasons that you were not aware of. And so I can imagine that it's not a whole lot different stepping into the chairman's role. Having observed Chairman Culver for a number of years, you know, being an opinionated politician like probably most of us are, you think, well, I want to do that different. I want to do this different? And there's some things that we're going to do different, but there's a lot of things that, you know, we do them for a good reason. And so as I am preparing to step into this role, again, I want to minimize my mistakes. That's the best way to keep moving forward, is to not go backwards. And so I want to learn everything that he knows and appreciate all of his ideas and the way he sees things, so that I might come to a different conclusion, but I want to understand his line of thinking before I go off and make a decision.
And Mark, this is an unusual transition. This is really not what's going on in most counties. What's going on in most counties is John Smith, commissioner, either decided not to run and someone from the outside won that seat, or maybe he or she ran and were defeated. After 30 years of being in office as a county commissioner, could you talk a little bit about the need to put pride aside and try to work together on a positive transition?
Well, let's be clear, 36 years, but yes, I absolutely encourage everyone that either has a similar situation to us or even that has new commissioners coming in to think about the county that has given them the honor of serving as a commissioner and work with the person that's taking their place, whether it be an existing commissioner or not. People run for office and they make all kind of statements about, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, and they find out real quick that they can't do any of that. You know, we're elected as commissioners, but the commission takes action. A commissioner can't really do anything. And so you'll learn a lot as you take office, that you work as a group, you've got to be a team. There are things you've got to learn that you can and can't do. Obviously, we have courses that we, the association, and through training will teach new officials, new commissioners, some of the things that they can and can't do. But I just encourage everyone to take advantage of people that have been in office. If you've got our situation, you know, work together. There's no reason to put up fences. You're working for the good of the county. I've been doing this a long time. I'm not
36 years
to be accurate. Yes. I'm not going to be here. Commissioner Shoup is now going to be Chairman Shoup, and Houston County is my home, and I want Houston County to continue to grow. The way I can do that is helping him be the best chairman he can possibly be.
And I greatly appreciate it.
I was going to say, Brandon, that's really what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You don't sit in this job or in the job that he's been in for 36 years because you don't like it. You have to be passionate about it, because 36 years, especially this day and age, is a very long time. So his passion has always been evident to me, that he always is doing what he thinks is best, not for him, not necessarily for county commission as an individual governing body, but what's best for the people that we represent. And so I've learned a lot from him, and looking forward to assuming the mantle of leadership and pushing this county forward.
Guys, I appreciate very much you taking a few minutes to visit with us and with the county family on the July edition of the 2 North Jackson podcast. Look forward to seeing you both at the convention. Until then, y'all be safe, and we'll join you again in August for the 2 North Jackson podcast.